history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there waiting to be told. Stories that, when you take a little time to listen, might just add to your perspective. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we take those steps, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The calendar says that Veterans Day weekend has arrived. It's a holiday that exists as a reminder that all veterans, any man or woman who has worn the uniform, regardless of when or where or for how long, they are all worthy of our gratitude. Of course, here at Hometown Heroes, we like to say that every weekend is Veterans Day weekend and that our gratitude certainly should not be limited to just this time of year. A lot of the 75th anniversaries you've been hearing about with regard to World War II and the ones you're going to be hearing about over the next 10 or 11 months have to do with battles on land or sea. But anniversaries of air engagements are a little less clearly defined, and it's not too often they receive the same kind of attention. Today, we're going to hear from three different men who 75 years ago today were facing a very uncertain future as prisoners of war because they had all been shot down on the same day, attacking the same target. We'll learn about it first from a bombardier on one of the 638 B-17 bombers the 8th Air Force launched that day. Dean Whitaker was just a teenager from Southern California, but he became quite familiar with Merseburg, Germany.
Synthetic oil plant at Merseburg was a major target. The Germans were running out of oil in their tanks, and that just didn't have enough to really put out a full effort. And so this target was very special. I think every gun in Germany was at that plant. They'd taken them all from Berlin, and the Air Force was the Luftwaffe was the only place they flew was Merseburg, and it was quite a battle. When I looked ahead and saw the flak, which is the black explosion of 88 millimeter shells going off, I thought, my God, we're going to be lucky to get through this. And we got through it fine. We were hit a few times. All I could tell when you were hit that we could smell the burning hot flak metal going through the ship. And we got out of that fine. And as soon as we were out of that, the Luftwaffe attacked us. The first attack, they always attack from the tail because their 20 millimeter cannon would go further than our 50 caliber machine gun. And so the tail gunner was really busy on that first mission. And I think he shot down one of the planes. One of the fellows said, you got one, over the intercom. And so on the second attack, we were hit really bad. The tail gunner was shot bad, and the waist gunner went back to check on him, and he did. He said he's dead. But that time, we were hit real bad, and the plane was out of control. The pilot gave the word to bail out, and me being the navigator, right by the nose escape hatch, I was the first one out. On the way, before I could go out, I had to release. I wore what they called a flak suit, armor vest, and I couldn't. There's an escape tag on that you pull, and it's supposed to be released. Well, it didn't release, and I was fighting that, trying to get that off, and I said, "Man, I got to get out of here." And you know, I had a voice, kind of. My father had passed away. About 8 months before I went in the service, and I thought I heard his voice say, "You get out of there now." So I did. I wanted to jump out. I said, "I can't wait any longer." I jumped out of the escape hatch of the nose. And as soon as I hit the slipstream, it tore the flak suit off, but my parachute was only fastened on one side because I couldn't fasten the other side when the flak suit was on. So here I was fighting all the way down, trying to fasten the other side. And at 28,000 feet, You have no strength. You're just ready to pass out. And so I started entering some clouds at 3,000 feet. And I said, well, I better pull this now, whether it's fastened or not. And I pulled it, and I was floating down, and I could hear shots coming up at me. And the Germans were shooting at me as I was coming down.
And this was fire from their aircraft or from the ground?
Well, that was from the ground. It was civilians in the ground were shooting. They all had guns. And then the odd thing about this, when I was, before I hit the ground, I could hear cheering. And I thought, who the heck is cheering in the middle of Germany? And I just about landed in a German prisoner of war camp that held English prisoners. And luckily, a guard from this camp come running out of the camp and made the civilians stop shooting me. They had their rifles already aimed at me, and so they stopped shooting. And the guard gathered me up and took me into this camp, and the English prisoners of war gave us tea and crumpets. It was really something. Four members of my crew were not that lucky. They landed too far away for this soldier to save them, and they were killed by the German civilians. And they later paid for it when the GIs came in, and they had a trial, and I have the names of all the soldiers that did that, and I think they were executed for doing that.
Well, that's understandable, and I'm just struck. We talk about close calls, and you've already described a couple close calls in the air. But here, out of just the sheer chance of the order in which you get out of the airplane and where you come down, you could have been killed by angry German civilians. Instead, you landed where you were safe.
Yes, it was really safe. Then I did notice when I got down that my parachute was fastened on both sides. And I don't know. I had some help there.
So you have no idea how that other side got fastened?
No, it was done.
You talk about somebody looking out for you. That's a pretty clear indication. But that said, while you didn't suffer the fate that your crewmates did suffer, it was no picnic what you did endure. Where did they take you, and how were you treated?
Well, the SS takes you first to interrogation, and they're the worst of all the German soldiers. The Luftwaffe soldiers were really treated us well, but the SS was terrible, and we were taken to a schoolhouse. It was a pretty big battle that day. A lot of planes shot down, and we filled the schoolhouse with about 8 to 10 flyers, and two of them were shot really bad, and we tried to help them as much as we could, but the Germans would give them no help for the first 2 or 3 days, and we were in this schoolhouse, all of us together, and an incident happened there that I'll never forget. The soldier guarding us, he was a Wehrmacht soldier. He wasn't real bad. And he left to fill up his canteen with water once and left us there. And he locked the door and everything, but he left us by ourselves. And luckily, or unlucky for him, he was eating his lunch at the time. And when he got back, his lunch had disappeared. He says, "Who's ate my lunch?" And nobody said a word. But at least we had a little snack there.
And you didn't have to pay any punishment for that?
No, the German guard, they were halfway civilized. We were gone the next day. The Luftwaffe took us and interrogate us and see where we were from and all that. But and then they threatened to keep us until we told them where we were from and what we were bombing and everything. And we knew that all we had to tell them was name, rank, and serial number. And you tell them that, and that was it. And they were going to keep me in there for this cell we went to, had a single cell, and we were going to have to stay there for until we told them that. And they had an air raid that day on the town. I think it was Regensburg or something. And I watched this air raid from my cell window. Bars, and it was quite a sight. You know, I was a 19-year-old second lieutenant, and I nothing I could tell them that they didn't already know. And so I was only there 2 days, and then they sent me to Stalag Luft 3, which was the permanent camp for American officers. There was quite a movie made about Stalag Luth III.
And that's one of my favorites, The Great Escape. What a classic that is.
When I arrived at the camp, I realized that the camp was ran like an army base. We had a colonel was the head of our base, and it was run very strict. If you wanted to escape, you had to go to the escape committee and tell them your plans and everything and wait. But not many people tried that because it was pretty well guarded.
But after a couple of months there with Russian forces approaching the camp, the prisoners were evacuated from Stalag Luth III and forced to march through the snow to their next destination. They marched and marched for 10 days in brutal winter conditions.
We would sleep in a farm every night that gets a barn, and we'd sleep in the hay. And in the morning, you'd wonder who was in the hay with you because you couldn't see anybody. You're covered up with hay. And we just managed to keep warm.
So then after 10 days, they put you on 40 and 8s and took you to another camp.
Yes, we got in these 48s, and they were so crowded you had to stand. There was no room to sit. There was a few guys who were pretty sick, and we'd make room for them to lay down. One occasion, it's Christmas time, and somebody started singing Silent Night. The whole train caught on to that, and you could hear a trainload of GIs singing Silent Night.
Something tells me that each Christmas now, when you hear that song, you probably go back to that 40 and 8.
Yeah, that's true. It sure reminds you of that occasion, because it was really hard sleeping in those car standing up, and I think we were relieved two times to get out and go to the bathroom, and in those 2 days or 3 days on that train, I don't recall just exactly, but it was an ordeal.
So it was probably a relief when you arrived at your next destination, even though you were a prisoner there.
Yes, we crossed the Danube, I believe it was, and then this got little town of Moosburg. It wasn't a city, it was a town, and we marched through that town, and all the German civilians were hanging out of their window with a swastika. Later on, after we were liberated, we walked by that same town, and all the white flags were out.
That's a sharp contrast, and a very good one on the second half of that. So at this new prison camp, were the conditions the same? Were they worse? And had your morale been impacted at all by all this that you've been through?
No, it was worse. The facilities were bad. We had no place to sleep. They had put up some temporary tents. And the first night, we slept in an old barn that had so many leaks in it. And I tried to find a place to sleep that wasn't getting dripped on. Couldn't find it. Everything leaked. But the next day they took us into temporary tents, and this was so crowded. When you slept, you had to sleep on the floor, and everybody was sleeping on the floor, and there was no room. If you had to get up at night, you had to walk over all these bodies. Unluckily, I had dysentery at the time and had to get up a few times during the night. But this dysentery enabled me to go into sick call, which was a permanent barracks that was run by a pre-med student, an Air Force captain. So he treated me, and I'll tell you a little story about him now. On our liberation, well, the first day we saw this infantry spotter planes coming over and knew they were spotting for the artillery. They sighted us and knew we were there. So I think there was 5,000 American officers in this camp. The next morning, we could hear the tanks. They were really making a lot of noise, rumbling. And every once in a while, they'd shoot some. The Germans, was broken up into the Luftwaffe guards who treated us decently and SS troops that were guarding us. Two different type individuals. When they heard the tanks coming, the Luftwaffe soldiers wanted to surrender to us, and they started coming into our camp. There was a road leading to our camp from a cheese plant next to us, and the SS troops started shooting their own soldiers that were coming into our camp. And the road coming into the camp, you could see the bodies of a few of them, and they were shooting up our camp too. And I got into a slit trench we had built, trying to get protected from the shots being fired into our camp. And one of the shots missed me about 12 inches, I guess. It hit the reeds that were supporting this slit trench. As soon as the tank saw the shooting from this tower, they shot it. And boy, that tire just blew to pieces by the tank's guns. All right, then that was in the morning. As soon as everything was cleared out, the tanks came into camp. I have a picture of the soldier, the infantryman, shooting the lock off of the gate to the camp. And behind him came the tanks. Were we ever glad to see them? Then, I don't know what the time was, and then a little bit later, after the tanks, General Patton came in with the tanks. I was in sick bay, which was in the first building, and I was standing at the stoop waiting to greet them. I didn't know he was coming, but he came over to the stoop, to the camp, to the door where I was, and asked me, he says, "How you doing, son?" I says, "Fine now that you're here, General." Well, he was there to see his son-in-law, the medic I was telling you about. It was his son-in-law. His son-in-law got hit by one of these stray bullets, but luckily it had gone through the building and it's pretty well spent. They did carry him out, but he was fine. And so General Patton took him with them and disappeared. Another thing that was quite an occasion for a lot of people, one of the captains on the infantry that liberated us, his brother was in our camp, in the tent, and he was going to really treat him. He took him out and shot a deer, brought the deer back, and was going to really treat the guys in that tent for venison dinner. Well, we all got sick. It was just too strong. We didn't eat much of it, but what there was, we were not used to that. So there was another occasion where that afternoon a donut truck came in, a Red Cross donut truck, if you can imagine that. They didn't have any donuts. You know, we tried to bum some donuts. Oh, no, we already gave away. But one of the Red Cross workers in the donut truck, her husband was in camp, and you should see the reunion.
Sure, when you watched those reunions, you imagined your own.
When we went through New York Harbor and the fireboat come out and sprayed and really celebrated, I felt, well, we're home. Everything turned out so well for me, and I have our God to thank.
That is Dean Whitaker, a resilient ex-prisoner of war who's still going strong in Las Vegas at age 94. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, another man shot down on that mission to Merseburg 75 years ago and his story of survival. This special Veterans Day edition of Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.